From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the Ebola outbreak, Boko Haram's advance in northern Nigeria, deadly attack at a Jerusalem synagogue, plus angry residents in eastern Ukraine. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. In Sierra Leone, a seventh doctor has died of Ebola. He is Dr. Moses Carbo, a retired medical officer who volunteered to fight the spread of the deadly virus. He died at the Hastings Ebola Treatment Center near Freetown on Tuesday. The death was announced as European Union officials warned thousands more health workers are needed to halt and eradicate Ebola. Vytenis Andriukaitis is the EU Health Commissioner.
The Ebola response is switching from defense to offense. The medical workers are going to meet the disease where it is, in the cities and in the rural communities. The response is following the geography of the virus from top-down treatment model in the capitals and bigger cities to bottom-up model, a fight based on community approach.
In India, a 26-year-old man who recovered from Ebola in Liberia has been placed in isolation at the New Delhi airport after traces of the disease were found in his body. Here in the U.S. on Tuesday, the Minneapolis-based humanitarian organization American Refugee Committee said it's preparing to send a team of medical responders to Liberia. The 11 healthcare workers will include 5 Liberian Americans. And at the White House on Tuesday, President Obama spoke with a number of his advisors about the Ebola crisis, including the U.S. Ebola Response Coordinator, Ron Klain. As the meeting began, Mr. Obama spoke about the outbreak.
As long as the outbreak continues to rage in the 3 countries in West Africa, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, this is still going to be a danger, not just for America, but for the entire world. We are nowhere near out of the woods yet in West Africa. The good news is in parts of Liberia, our efforts, both civilian and military, are really paying dividends. And we are seeing the curve bending so that we are on track with diligence dealing with the hot spots that may still reemerge to actually get a handle on that disease.
An official of the World Health Organization, Dr. Pierre Formenti, told a news conference in Geneva Tuesday the number of Ebola cases will drop sharply in the new year, but a lot hinges, he says, on the development of rapid diagnostic tests. He called on drug makers to devise such testing. Formenti said these testing kits will be crucial, that is, for the aggressive testing needed to finally declare the outbreak over.
We have missed several chain of transmission that have been going, I would say, in the population, in the community. And we need to find this one to be able to say the outbreak is over. So we will need, in 4 to 6 months from now, to increase the number of laboratory tests to be sure that we are not missing cases.
The WHO hopes to find a test that can give results in 30 minutes and can be easily stored with no need for a power supply or maintenance and no biosafety requirements beyond the usual personal protective equipment worn for treating Ebola patients. Meanwhile, Britain's Queen Elizabeth voiced concerns malaria risks being sidelined by the world focus on Ebola. In an audience with David Heyman, professor of infectious diseases at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, the Queen said more people die from malaria every week than from Ebola. Also in the news, the French press agency reporting that veteran diplomat Michel Kafando just sworn in as Burkina Faso's interim president to oversee a year-long transition to civilian rule will appoint former interim military leader Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Zida today as prime minister. Zida was tapped to lead the military administration in charge of the West African country following the October 31st ouster of longtime president Blaise Compaoré. Boko Haram's brief occupation of the town of Chibok last week showed that no part of Nigeria's northeast is safe from the insurgent group, not even the town where the militants infamously kidnapped more than 200 schoolgirls earlier this year. Analysts are saying Boko Haram is making gains along Nigeria's border with Cameroon, and the military has not shown the ability to stop them. Chris Stein has more from Abuja.
When Boko Haram came into Chibok with guns blazing Friday, it felt like insult added to injury for many of the people of the town. The group has murdered thousands, shut down schools, and torched markets in its 5 years of violence across Nigeria's northeast. But its most famous crime was abducting more than 200 schoolgirls from Chibok in April. While the military has been criticized for not doing enough to prevent the kidnappings, Nigeria's armed forces have retaken Chibok from Boko Haram. But an elder in the town, Ayuba Chibok, says the government could do more to stop Boko Haram from seizing any territory.
Truly speaking, if government wanted Boko Haram to be stopped, they will do it. I don't know why, if Boko Haram visited places, the soldiers will be fleeing, even though they have been complaining that they don't have sufficient or enough weapon that they will be able to combat Boko Haram with.
Boko Haram's assault on the town fits in with the group's larger campaign of seizing territory in northeastern Nigeria, says Ryan Cummings, chief Africa analyst at Red 24, a South Africa-based crisis management firm.
Boko Haram is also seeming, and it's always been their motivation and goal to create a, wouldn't necessarily call it the term caliphate, but to create a state within Nigeria, which is completely devoid from the governance of Nigeria's secular federal administration, and which is in totality ruled under Sharia law. And obviously the capture of Chibok, in addition to various other urban centers within the region, is obviously congruent with them trying to form this independent Islamist state.
Bawa Abdullahi Wasi, a security analyst and executive associate at Nigeria-based Network for Justice, said Boko Haram is divided between different groups with different aims, but the attack on Chibok is an attempt to present themselves as a united and powerful front.
They are trying to prove to the authority that they are still powerful. They are trying to prove to the world that they are not dispersed and taken off as the authority seems to be claiming. So if at all, anybody will want to believe that they are no longer any much of relevance. They are now of relevance.
The group is thought to have taken over several local government areas in Borno State, one of three northeastern states the government placed under emergency rule last year due to the insurgency. The government announced Tuesday that it intends to continue that emergency status for another 6 months. But while Chibok might be the most famous town in Borno State, it's not necessarily the most important, Cummings says.
It's garnered this international attention, and that's why everyone is focused, you know, on Boko Haram's capturing of the town. There are various other urban centers and settlements in northeastern Nigeria, which probably from a strategic perspective, but also in terms of the number of people residing within those communities and their economic and administrative importance in the northeast, was probably more notable than Chibok.
Many of Boko Haram's strongholds lie along Nigeria's border with Cameroon. Cummings notes, without pressure on both sides of the border, neither Chibok nor the rest of northeastern Nigeria will be rid of the insurgents anytime soon. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
In the last 18 months of yet another armed conflict, as many as 10,000 children in the Central African Republic have been recruited to armed groups. To date, UNICEF has negotiated for the release of 1,400 of these young boys and girls who now face the struggle of reintegrating into society. Katerina Hoya has a report.
The attack on the village was swift and violent. During the Seleka rebel raid, some people were burned in their homes while others were shot as they tried to run. I'll never forget that day. Jerome says, his voice breaking. The Seleka killed my uncle that pushed me to join the anti-Balaka militia. Jerome is one of the over 2,000 children who have been released by armed groups since January. UNICEF deputy representative Judith Levelier has been in Bangui since August 2013.
At that time, we were estimating around 2,000 to 3,000 children associated with armed groups. And then in November, we revised the figures, and we were looking at something like 6,000 children associated with armed groups. And nowadays, we're talking between 6,000 to 10,000 children with armed groups. I mean, associated with armed groups. So it is a serious matter.
In less than 18 months, the CAR has seen rebels topple the government, retaliatory attacks by the militias, thousands killed and millions displaced. A UN peacekeeping mission is here struggling to restore order. In the continuing chaos, joining armed groups is still one of the only means of finding protection for many children who lost or were separated from their parents. Jerome says it was his only way to survive. Together with a couple of other boys, I used to put up a checkpoint on one of the small roads leading out of town. Those who wanted to pass were forced to give up money or food, Jerome says. Shortly after Serge joined the anti-Balaka, the militia attacked the capital on December 5th, 2013. When the militia attacked, we, the children, were always at the front, says Serge. He says he's 17, but his boy's features and thin frame make him look much younger. A majority of the children are recruited in their early teens, but some have yet to turn 10. A child's age and physique will determine their roles in armed groups. A well-built boy might be a fighter or carry arms to the front. Younger children become cleaners, says Serge. I was a good fighter, fearless. The commander liked me, recalls. One-fifth of the children being released are girls. They were used as cooks, cleaners, or were married off to commanders, says UNICEF Levelier.
They do all the chores, the camp chores, but they also act as sex slaves, or they get under the protection of one of the commanders, and sometimes they get pregnant. Some are really, really young, like 10, 12, 14 years old. So for them, once they are identified to be released from the armed group, we need to really pay attention to their needs and to make sure to provide them with support so that they can earn a living or go back to school and care for their child.
The Central African Republic has been plagued by conflict since the country's independence from France in 1960. In 2013, the Seleka ousted President François Bozize and rebel leader Michel Djotodia became the country's first Muslim president. In January this year, he handed over power to an interim government. Levelier says children were recruited as early as December 2012 as the Seleka advanced south through the region of Waka in northern Kar. Some children have spent up to 2 years with the rebels.
In some cases, they've gone so far in the level of atrocities that it's very difficult for them to return to where they are from. And if we don't accelerate and respond to the needs, there's a risk that there's going to be a lost generation in this country.
Today, half of the country's 4.5 million people are under 18, yet half the country's schools remain closed. This is Katerina Höje for VOA News in Bangui.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
A policeman wounded by gunfire in Tuesday's terrorist attack on a Jerusalem synagogue has died, bringing the death toll now to 5. We get more from VOA's Scott Bobb in Jerusalem.
The attack occurred during morning prayers at a synagogue in an ultra-Orthodox Jewish neighborhood in west of Jerusalem. Israeli police spokesman Mickey Rosenfeld said the synagogue was full of people praying.
two terrorist attacks using knives, an axe, and also a pistol, opening fire at everyone that was inside the synagogue. Our police officers that arrived at the scene engaged contact with those terrorists and shot and killed the terrorists within moments.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in a statement, promised to respond harshly and blamed the attack on what he called incitement by the militant Palestinian group Hamas and the head of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas. Mr. Abbas condemned the attack and said he condemns the killing of civilians no matter who is doing it. The militant group Hamas praised the attack, calling it a response to the continued Israeli crimes and the desecration of Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque. The mosque sits on the noble sanctuary or temple mount that is holy to Muslims and Jews. Violence between Israelis and Palestinians has surged in recent weeks, fueled by rising tension over the site. Non-Muslims may visit the site, but may not pray there, according to an agreement dating to the 1967 Israeli-Arab War. Some nationalist Israelis have been going to the site to pray, causing demonstrations and riots in East Jerusalem. Five Israelis and one foreigner have been killed in recent weeks by Palestinian attackers using knives and vehicles. More than a dozen Palestinians have been killed in clashes with police. In the most recent incident, a Palestinian bus driver was found hanged in his bus. An official autopsy determined that the death was suicide. But the victim's family rejected this, saying the body showed signs of violence. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Two new videos by jihadi groups show the conflicting roles of Europeans in brutal struggles waged by militant Islamists as both victims and as perpetrators. One shows French and Dutch hostages pleading for help. Another appears to show a Frenchman and possibly another one involved in an execution of Syrian soldiers as possible members of the Islamic State militants. Lisa Bryant reports.
French authorities confirmed that a new video showing Frenchman Serge Lazarevich asking France to help liberate him was authentic. The video was posted by Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which captured Lazarevich and another hostage 3 years ago in Mali. The other hostage, Philippe Verdun, was shot dead in 2012. The video also shows a Dutch hostage. Lazarevich is the last Frenchman being held hostage. Another hostage, Hervé Gourdel, was executed in September. Lazarevich's daughter, Diane, told French Radio Tuesday that it was shocking to see images of him so thin and weak. Diane Lazarevich says she hopes French President François Hollande does everything to secure her father's liberation before Christmas. A number of French hostages have been released over the years. France denies it pays ransom, but experts suggest this may happen through intermediaries. A report published by the New York Times claims Al-Qaeda and its affiliates have earned $125 million in ransom payments for French and other European hostages since 2008. A second video released Sunday shows another face of militant Islam, with Europe not only a target but an exporter of radical fighters. Authorities say 22-year-old French convert Maxime Ochar appears to be among Islamic State militants who are filmed executing Syrian soldiers. Another Frenchman may also be in the video. France's BFM TV interviewed Ochar by Skype in July. He described how he left his home in Normandy to join the Islamic State in Syria. He said he wants to become a martyr. Authorities estimate that thousands of Europeans have left their homelands to join the IS in Iraq and Syria, including nearly 1,000 French. France's response has also grown. Paris prosecutor François Moulin says the number of French judicial investigations linked to radical Islam has increased by 200% in just 1 year. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Addressing a meeting of supporters of Moscow on Tuesday, President Vladimir Putin accused the United States of seeking to, in his words, subdue Russia. It came just days after receiving a frosty reception at the G20 meeting in Australia and following fresh accusations that Moscow is putting increasing military pressure on Ukraine. Earlier Tuesday, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg told reporters he has information of a Russian military buildup inside Ukraine.
It is a military buildup, and the picture we have confirms the picture which is also provided by other sources, by open sources, by independent reporters, by the OSCE. They are also providing information about the military buildup, both inside Ukraine, but we also see a military buildup on the Russian side of the border. And we speak about troops, we speak about equipment, and we speak also about artillery and very modern air defense systems. So this is a serious military buildup, and we call on Russia to pull back its troops and contribute to a peaceful agreement.
Also Tuesday, Ukraine's Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk called on Russia to, in his words, hold serious negotiations on a neutral territory. Moscow has repeatedly denied directly supporting the rebellion in eastern Ukraine and has described Russian troops seen fighting alongside pro-Russian separatists there as volunteers. Citizens of Donetsk in eastern Ukraine say they did not ask for pro-Moscow separatists to take over their city, and they should not be punished for the breakaway insurgency by the Ukrainian government in Kiev, which will end the funding of all public services in rebel-held areas by this weekend. Jamie Debmer in Donetsk has details.
On a misty and bitingly frigid Tuesday morning here in central Donetsk, more than 200 mainly elderly people, wrapped up against the sharp cold, start queuing up for food handouts donated by a local business oligarch. They say without the aid, they would starve. The aid is crucial, says 43-year-old Alicia, a widow and mother of two. A lot of people don't have anything to eat. Old people aren't getting their pensions unless they're able to drive outside separatist-controlled areas to register and then collect their allowances, she says. Most of the elderly and infirm don't have the means to do so. The aid centre in Kalinitskaya district is open every day and hands out bags containing basic foodstuffs, from butter to cooking oil and grains, as well as processed and canned food. Each bag contains enough food for 2 weeks, and recipients can return twice a month for supplies. The centre is funded by one of the eastern city's biggest business oligarchs, Renat Akhmatov, who has fled to Kiev. There is a surreal aspect to daily life in the city. The growl of artillery and rocket exchanges can be heard on the outskirts of Donetsk, mainly from heavy fighting around the wrecked airport to the north and in sharp skirmishes to the east. Near the airport, a well-heeled district is virtually empty of people who have fled because Grad rockets and shells were overshooting. In the southern edge of the centre, shops and malls remain open, but retailers have trouble restocking, and most people do not have the cash to buy. At the weekend, Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko, amidst a military build-up by Russia and Ukrainian reinforcements being rushed to the east, announced the government would stop funding public services in insurgent-held areas in Donetsk and Luhansk, the two easternmost provinces. That includes halting funding of public hospitals. Reaction from civilians in the city of Donetsk is fierce.
Пенсію ми не получаємо вже 4-5 місяців. Діло в тому, що ДНРці прийшли. Ми ж не знали, що вони прийшли і як.
Галина is a 66-year-old pensioner. She says she's not received a state pension for 4 months and is worried about the ending of funding of public services. She says the separatists took over the city and no one asked them to do this. But why should Kiev punish ordinary people? She asked angrily, without state funding, what should ordinary people do? Just starve and die? Kiev hopes that by isolating Moscow-backed rebel-held areas, it will push ordinary people to turn against separatists. But some critics fear it will have the opposite effect, saying most locals opposed to the insurgency have long fled, leaving either die-hard supporters or those too poor or old to go. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Donetsk.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
New York's Times Square was illuminated by the world's highest resolution video display screen of its size as the monitor was switched on Tuesday evening First images broadcast from the enormous screen included a digital film featuring images of mountains, of birds, skyscrapers, and bursts of color accompanying a musical soundtrack. Panel located on the side of a hotel is 8 stories tall and is intended for advertisements similar to those on dozens of other screens lining the bustling New York City streets. Seems that hundreds of tourists brave the frigid temperatures to look at this display. In fact, hundreds of thousands of people, many of them from New York and tourists alike, are on Times Square each day. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. Latest news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On November 19, 1863, President Abraham Lincoln delivered one of the most famous speeches in American history at the dedication of the Military Cemetery at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Lincoln's 10 sentences received little attention at first, but Northern newspapers took note of their powerful message in which he articulated the meaning of the U.S. Civil War. On this day in 1887, fictional detective Sherlock Holmes made his debut in A Study in Scarlet, a story written by British physician Conan Doyle. Specializing in solving unusual cases using his extraordinary powers of observation and logical reasoning, Sherlock Holmes would appear in 4 novels and 56 short stories. On this day in 1942, the Soviet Red Army launched a huge counteroffensive against German troops that turned the tide in the Battle of Stalingrad and eventually in the war between Germany and the Soviet Union. And on this day in 1961, record industry history was made when Chubby Checker's original hit song, The Twist, re-entered the charts on its way to becoming the first record to reach number one for a second time. The Twist reached the top position in 1960, but Checker's appearance on the popular Ed Sullivan Show pushed it back onto the charts. Come on, baby. Chubby Checker was born Ernest Evans, but the wife of TV host Dick Clark suggested the name Chubby Checker as a takeoff on then-popular singer Fats Domino. The name stuck, and Chubby Checker and his dance craze, The Twist, became a part of music history. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A push by supporters of President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud to remove Somalia's prime minister from office is threatening to paralyze the government there. A parliamentary debate over Abdulwali Sheikh Ahmed's leadership on November 11th erupted in shouting, whistling, and catcalls, forcing the speaker to halt the session. At issue was a proposed no-confidence vote against the prime minister, which was being pressed by lawmakers loyal to the president. The two leaders fell out after the prime minister moved a minister allied with the president to another cabinet position last month. Prime Minister Abdulwali's predecessor, Abdi Farah Shirdan, was removed from office by parliament last year after a similar dispute with the president that paralyzed the government for months. The United States notes with concern the recent political turmoil in Somalia. Actions to put forward a parliamentary motion for a vote of no confidence in the prime minister do not serve the interests of the Somali people. The United States remains neutral in the dispute between the president and prime minister. We are committed to the principles of the New Deal Compact, which aims to build a sovereign, secure, democratic, united, and federal Somalia. Because Somalia's leadership is distracted with political division, the United States currently does not see the utility in sending a delegation to the High-Level Partnership Forum on Somalia, which is meeting in Copenhagen to review progress under the New Deal. We stand with the international community in urging the federal government of Somalia to implement fully its Vision 2016 plan and rise above the political differences that divert from the important work of unifying the country under a federal framework.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.